We are ready now to begin session 173. We invite you all to sit down and end your conversations. Thank you. This is session 173, Where Have All the Children Gone? Keeping the Faith and Passing It On. This session is sponsored by the Mormon Women's Forum. We would also like to invite you to Counterpoint Conference, which is going to be November 2nd at the University of Utah. Oh, sorry, November 1st. Thank you, Margaret. I couldn't remember whether it was the 1st or the 2nd. So it's a Saturday, so keep that in mind in case I got the date wrong. November 1st at the University of Utah, Counterpoint Conference. Churches have always struggled to find a way to involve the rising generation. The church as an institution seeks to perpetuate itself. It does this both through missionary work and by claiming the children of its members as new members. There is a tension between the church as a tribe and the church as a community of believers. When the tribe is emphasized, the characteristics of group identity, the definition of boundaries, and questions of authority and tradition are important. When the church as a community of believers is emphasized, conversion, individual spiritual paths, and connections with God are important. The Mormon Church began as a community of believers, but has steadily evolved toward tribalism. However, the tension between the two still exists. Tribes claim the children of their members. It is the responsibility of the tribal church to inculcate its values, traditions, and culture in the children so that they will be good church members. In the LDS Church, this is also the responsibility of the parents. And a further responsibility is to make sure that the children gain a testimony of the fundamental church beliefs. Elder Jeffrey R. Holland addressed this institutional expectation in his April 2003 conference talk. He warned parents that expressing liberal views and doubts will put their children in danger of not developing faith in God and leaving the church. Holland kept faith in God, faith in the church, and faith in the prophets and apostles who lead the church firmly attached. His words did not leave any possibility that faith in Christ might develop while faith in the church diminished. Although he said, in this church there is an enormous amount of room for studying and learning, for comparing and considering, for discussion and awaiting further revelation, he left no room for evaluating and questioning, for discerning truth and receiving revelation. Holland's tone was scolding, and his characterization of liberal parents was negative. He said they are given to cynicism or skepticism. In matters of whole-soul devotion, they always seem to hang back a little. And at the church's doctrinal campsite, they always like to pitch their tents out on the periphery of religious faith. He seems not to have noticed that a questioning mind, deep devotion, and faith in God can and often do go together. He suggests that the motives of those who question anything about the church are to be clever and independent. But couldn't their motives be to seek truth and live with integrity? Holland's talk brought up some important issues. Can the church community be supportive of critical thinking without endangering faith? As we pursue a path of inquiry and evaluation, what is our responsibility to our children and fellow Latter-day Saints? Should we share our explorations, questions, and doubts with our children and other church members? Is there a place in the church for people whose commitment to God and or truth comes before their commitment to the organizational church? These issues need to be honestly and thoughtfully addressed, but Holland's talk was very painful for me to listen to and reflect upon, not just because he gave people like me a severe scolding and imputed unworthy motives to us, and characterized us unfairly, but because it brought up some faint, painful history and disappointed hopes. 10 years ago, when the church troubles began for me and my family and some of my friends, my oldest daughter had just gotten married in the temple, my oldest son was on his mission, my second son would leave in a year, and we were very active in the church. I even accepted such callings as den mother and nursery leader. My roots in the church are very deep. My ancestors were in Nauvoo and Hans Mill. They crossed the plains and pioneered in Utah and Arizona. As a young woman with a questioning, seeking mind, I was interested in the questions of philosophy and religion. I stayed in Mormonism because I believed it was a religious tradition in which all questions could be explored and in which the area of exploration was all of reality. I believe that Mormonism encouraged me to explore the thinking and experiences of all other faith traditions to find the treasures they have to offer us, to learn from literature, philosophy, art, science, and all of human experience, as well as from our scriptures and history. I believed that Mormonism would support my search for meaning, understanding, depth, and inclusivity in my life. To me, the founding myth of Mormonism is powerful and spiritually compelling. A young boy searching for an answer to his desire to know how to be saved receives an answer from God. The church worked hard to disabuse me of such notions. After the church made its anti-symposia pronouncement, my oldest daughter said to me, "Before we moved to Utah, I thought Sunstone was for people like you who were very serious about religion, people who didn't get enough at church and wanted more." One of my teenage sons recently made the decision to stop going to church. It was a matter of integrity for him. He didn't feel he could keep going to church when he had so many disagreements with what he heard and when people had so many expectations for him, which he didn't have for himself. One day he and I were talking and he shared his version of Pascal's wager, although he didn't call it that. He said, "I'm not sure if there is a God or not, but if there is, he would love you no matter what. A God who didn't love you unconditionally wouldn't be a God that I would worship. A God who loved you unconditionally wouldn't care whether or not you went to church. But churches can do a lot of harm. They can really mess you up." Our panel will respond to Holland's talk and the issues he raised. Now I'd like to introduce them to you. We have Vicki Stewart Eastman. Vicki is a frequent participant on Sunstone panels with Mormon culture, dealing with Mormon culture. She is the mother of four grown children, all of whom were teenagers in 1993 when six prominent LDS scholars were excommunicated. Now in their 20s, two sons are active. One son is inactive, and a daughter has left the church. Vicki taught gospel doctrine for 4 years and is currently a primary chorister. Professionally, she is a freelance executive recruiter. Vicki is in a second marriage to her first boyfriend in high school, and she lives in Oklahoma. Next, we have Neil Chandler. Neil is the Creative Writing Program Coordinator at Cleveland State University. He is the co-editor of Dialogue, along with his wife, Rebecca, and he is the father of eight children. Next, we have Nadine Hansen. Nadine is a longtime Sunstone participant. She has participated in many Mormon Women's Forum-sponsored panels, as has Vicki. She is a semi-retired lawyer, a mother of four, and the grandmother of three. And last of all, we have Laura Hansen. She's Nadine's daughter. As the daughter of liberal Mormons, Laura has learned to love her God, her family, her country, her education, and to appreciate the beauty of this world and the diversity of the people who live in it. She works as a legal secretary in Palo Alto, California, and that gives her the time and resources to focus on her hobbies outside of the office, which include music, hiking, photography, and reading, among other things. For the past 10 years or so, she's been involved with young women's programs in various wards in California and Colorado and has seen the daughters of both liberal and conservative parents grow in the gospel and seek answers to the questions they have. Vicki, Neil, and Nadine will discuss their own faith and doubts and how the ways they have expressed their views have affected their children's faith and relationships to the church. And Laura will talk about her upbringing, how her parents' attitudes affected her own faith development, her relationship to the church now, and what she anticipates for the future. Or they may just have their own version of this. We'll see. Vicki?
I have a great deal of liking and respect for Elder Jeffrey Holland. To me, he stands out among the Quorum of the Twelve as having a firm sense of the love and grace of God. His conference talks have led us to consider such topics as the poor in new and helpful ways. He clearly reads fine Christian writers outside of Mormonism and so avoids the trap so common in General Conference talks of endlessly quoting other general authorities without adding anything new to the discussion. Elder Holland's talk in the October 2002 conference entitled The Other Prodigal stands out in my mind as the finest General Conference talk I have ever heard. A magnificent explication of the concept of grace in our lives and a wonderful counterbalance to recent Ensign articles on the conditional love of God. So when Elder Holland rose to speak in this year's April conference, I was ready for more spiritual food. Instead, I heard him take to task all parents in the church whose personal beliefs are not completely orthodox and who do not forcefully proclaim those beliefs to their children. I quote, "But no child in this church should be left with uncertainty about his or her parents' devotion to the Lord Jesus Christ, the restoration of his church, and the reality of living prophets and apostles who now, as in earlier days, lead the church according to the will of the Lord, the mind of the Lord, the word of the Lord, and the power of God unto salvation." Well, this is setting a pretty high standard for parents, in my opinion. There was some comment on one of my email lists that perhaps what he meant is that parents should not withhold their religious beliefs from their children. I certainly agree with that, but that's not what Elder Holland said. Not only does he require that parents share their religious beliefs, he specifies what those beliefs are to be. As a parent and a liberal Mormon, a category he mentioned specifically, I, of course, immediately began to ask myself, "Lord, is it I? Have I ruined my children's church activity through my endless thinking and questioning, even in faith? Does this paragraph of Elder Holland's talk describe me?" Quote, "In offering such a prayer for the young, may I address a rather specific aspect of their safety. In this I speak carefully and lovingly to any of the adults at the church, parents or otherwise, who may be given to cynicism or skepticism, who in matters of whole-souled devotion always seem to hang back a little, who at the church's doctrinal campsite always like to pitch their tents out on the periphery of religious faith. As Janice noted, I think this equation of faith and doctrine is a little troubling to me. I consider it to be both untrue and hitting below the belt, since faith and doctrinal belief can be two very different things. There are some other unfair equations in the talk, for instance, that a liberal view of Mormonism is motivated solely by a desire to be clever or independent. But to return to Elder Holland's remarks, to all such whom we do love and wish were more comfortable camping nearer to us, I say, please be aware that the full price to be paid for such a stance does not always come due in your lifetime. No, sadly, some elements of this can be a kind of profligate national debt, with payments coming out of your children's and grandchildren's pockets in far more expensive ways than you ever intended it to be. Or this paragraph, did this one apply to me? We can be reasonably active, meeting-going Latter-day Saints, but if we do not live lives of gospel integrity and convey to our children powerful, heartfelt convictions regarding the truthfulness of the restoration and the divine guidance of the church from the first vision to this very hour, then those children may, to our regret but not our surprise, turn out to be not visibly active, meeting-going Latter-day Saints, or sometimes anything close to it. Well, of course, so I took a look at my own family. I have four children, all the product of a first marriage that lasted 26 years. During that time, we lived in Northern California, and my husband and I were active temple-going members. I spent years in the primary and headed up home scripture study and family home evenings. I also subscribed to Dialogue and Sunstone, attended Sunstone symposiums frequently, and reacted strongly to the church's opposition to the ERA. When all of my children were in their teens, I was divorced and moved from Northern California to Utah. Our family fell into an emotional and financial crisis that took several years to resolve. So where do things stand now? Son number one, Tom. Tom was seriously injured as a child, and that has affected his adult life. So even though he's not active in the church, it's probably due to factors other than his renegade mother. This is not to say that Tom is not a fairly spiritual person or is hostile to the church. Son number two, Adam. He married a girl from a strong LDS family and is completely active in believing. He is starting an MBA program at BYU this fall. Son number three, James. active but questioning. He served a mission but has wide-ranging discussions on religious topics with his friends online. He's starting medical school at the University of Utah. He's not married yet, if any of you would like to apply. My daughter Megan, the youngest, moved back to California for college at UC Berkeley and has completely left the church. She recently graduated and is living and working in San Francisco. So I'm batting about 500, 50% active, 50% inactive. Speaking on this panel gave me a good chance to talk with my children about how my non-conservative views have influenced them. I didn't actually interview my son Adam for this panel since he's been very busy, but I will relate a conversation we had a couple of years ago. I need to preface this by telling you that I honestly tried to convey my religious feelings to my children in family home evening, but I finally gave up. They would laugh and poke each other and mock me to the point that several evenings ended up with me leaving abruptly and crying in my bedroom. So I finally decided not to cast my pearls before such little swine. And we went to an activity format rather than a lesson, focusing on things like fire safety inspections or games, with refreshments at the end. To my surprise, a couple of years ago, my son Adam, now grown, volunteered how much he had enjoyed family home evening as a child. I told him that they were a pure horror for me and asked him what he liked about them. I guess I had a secret hope that my heartfelt teachings had struck home with someone. I really liked the refreshments, he said. So that's the naked truth about how successful I was in letting my children know of my religious beliefs when they were young. Here's what my third son, James, wrote. Growing up, I knew that you were against certain policies of the church, but I don't recall ever considering you as rebellious in any way. In fact, most of my line-toeing, rule-obeying behavior can be credited to you by making us go to church when we didn't want to and behave while there. And since I saw you mostly in your capacity as a primary chorister, a small horror for me because I didn't want to sing, but you were there watching, I never saw your questions or concerns. I probably wasn't aware of your disagreements with the church until after we moved to Utah. While in Utah, I took many of your disagreements with the church as just a place for you to vent your anger about the divorce. Mostly, though, I just didn't have the passion for it that you did. So religion was mostly a tradition for me anyway. It wasn't until right before my mission that I started cluing in on what you were doing. Part of the reason is that you were following Brother Holland's advice by keeping much of your activity secret from me. I had no idea what Dialogue or Mormon Alliance were until you started telling me. Until I was 19, I would have probably said that I came from a standard Mormon religious household. So what effect did all of this have on me? Nothing, none in particular, except that I seem rather late in starting to question my fundamentals. Now I wish you had been more open. But I really think I was just plainly disinterested in religion as a teenager, and still now to some degree, so maybe you did the best you could. Probably more than you wanted to know. Love, James. So to summarize so far, Adam was mostly influenced by the refreshments, and James just wasn't that interested in my religion, in any religion. To my surprise, Adam once told his wife that when he started at BYU, he really didn't know that much about Mormonism. And this after growing up in an LDS home, years of primary and young men, Sunday school and seminary. Well, it was not for lack of trying. I can only conclude that church teaching isn't very effective, or that boys aren't really interested in religion until they're about 18. Just in time, might I add. Now, Megan, my only daughter, is a more instructive example. I interviewed her about why she has left the church. Now 23, Megan was 13 when we moved from the more liberal culture of California to the much more conservative culture of Utah. We arrived in the summer of 1993 to live in the same ward as Paul and Margaret Toscano, ground zero within 4 months for the September 1993 excommunications. I'll admit, I was furious over the excommunications and almost left the church then. I was not quiet about my feelings. Megan, actually, though, was more upset during this time about the divorce and the relocation. She said the repeated blows to our family made her question the church's rosy view of life and wonder why so many horrible things would happen to us. Her anger at her father, an active Melchizedek priesthood holder, crossed over to all men, and she didn't see why she should trust or obey them. When asked to quantify, she said that about 25% of her disillusionment came from hearing me question the church's positions. The rest came from a combination of turmoil in her life and an increasing sense that the church's plans for her were not a fit. To be honest, she also absorbed from me more of an awareness of feminist issues than did her brothers. I need to acknowledge, however, that Megan received counseling during our early time in Salt Lake from a very effective part-time counselor at LDS Social Services. This helped considerably to calm her down short-term, but it didn't really mitigate the long-term negative effect of the religious issues. I was very grateful for this help from the church. A powerful negative factor for Megan, ironically, was her ninth grade seminary teacher, who, for fear of a lawsuit, I will call Brother Loser. He embodied Mormonism at its worst, close-minded, ill-informed, sexist, racist, and very homophobic. He told the class that the gays were invading Salt Lake and that if he weren't a seminary teacher, he'd go to a gay bar and beat one up. He told of going to a bookstore to look at pornography so he would know what the kids had to deal with. This is a ninth grade teacher, folks. Brother Loser asked Megan why she had moved from California, and when she replied that it was due to her parents' recent divorce, he gave the opinion that her mother, meaning me, must hate men. When I confronted Brother Loser personally about this, he said that Megan was lying about what he'd said. This horrible man put Megan on a very bad track with Mormonism as practiced in Utah. If I had been in a stronger place personally, I would have documented his abuses and demanded his termination. It's amazing how very conservative career seminary teachers can get away with the most ridiculous, even evil teaching without ever being called to account by the CES organization. Megan also reacted badly to such things as the lesson on sexuality that she had in Young Women, where a nail is pounded into the board and then removed. The moral is that even if you repent by removing the nail, the hole is still there and you are a damaged person. I was amazed this stupid concept was still being presented. Megan felt that this teaching was in direct contradiction to the atonement of Christ. She was also angry at being excluded from her brother's temple wedding because she was too young. Megan related to me a comment by her cousin Allison, who has also left the church. Allison says that the church is like a bright red sweater. On some people it fits well and the color looks great. On others it fits poorly and it looks awful. Megan says that this red sweater just doesn't fit her. In summary, she left the church due to its conservative political bent, its excluding culture, the young women's lessons, her seminary teachers, the patriarchal organization, and the fact that she was in a non-traditional family, and the standard programs offered no help or support for that. So I can't resist pointing out that the church itself, its programs, some of its career seminary teachers, and its seriously out-of-date lessons, especially for young women, is responsible for many children leaving. Looking back on it, I believe my children were protected from my questioning before they grew older, both by their indifference and by my care. Because I was more orthodox in their younger lives, they were pretty clear about where I stood then. There was even an occasion or two when they surprised me in my room on my knees in prayer, something Elder Holland mentions. This talk raises the unresolved question of what parents are to do if they're unable to proclaim what Elder Holland asks of them. Do they stay silent? Do they lie? Do they withdraw from activity? Do they just send their children to primary and hope that will teach them? Do they have to leave Mormonism if they can't come up to Elder Holland's standard? After all, many parents, besides those in the liberal camp, are grappling with orthodoxy too. Then, too, complete orthodoxy does not seem to guarantee that children will stick with the church either. After all, even the best parent of all, God himself, saw a third of his children turn away from him, and I'm sure he had great refreshments at family home evening. I have considered three families with grown children in my larger extended family to try to determine how the parents have affected the church activity of the children. In my family of origin, my parents were active but not temple attending and did not overtly teach religion in our home. It was a situation of benign neglect. Of the six children, three are active today, 50%. In my own family, I worked a lot harder at teaching and living religion in our home, but of my four children, two are active, again, 50%. I look at my brother and his wife, orthodox and devout, who have done everything they could to demonstrate religious conviction, encourage, and testify to their children, meeting Elder Holland's standards in every way. Of those four children, two are active and two are not, 50% again. It seems that we got the same result through a variety of methods. The decision to be active in the church seems to be a subtle combination of parental influence and a whole lot of other influences. And rather than all being carried off by temptation, often children just grow up and make their own decision about that red sweater. My goal for my children is not that they be Orthodox members of the LDS Church, although I'm happy if they continue with the church since we have a long tradition in it. Rather, my wish for them is that they be alive spiritually, that they have faith in God, that they learn to love and live with joy, that they add goodness to the world. Elder Holland's comment that we hold life together between the generations with faith and prayer is absolutely correct. What form that faith will take is very individual, however, and can't be prescribed even by a general authority. It is true that parents should make whatever faith they have evident for their children to see. I disagree, however, with the harsh tone in general of this address. I continue to be intrigued by the placement of this address immediately after the October conference talk on the other prodigal, Elder Holland's most enlightened effort. Was he required to take on this latter topic in an effort to rein him in? Was it a loyalty test he had to pass to deal harshly with a community he seems to understand? Who knows? I have, however, benefited in that his talk prompted this evaluation of religious belief in my family, for in retrospect, I feel that I did right by my children, and I'm delighted by every one of them, active or not. I sincerely look forward to other topics Elder Holland will address. Believe me, he's at his best when he is singing the song of redeeming love. Thank you.
I'm the one man on the panel this evening, and I feel in some ways I'm here because I'm a man. And that's good. It could easily have been my wife, and I want to speak for her to some degree. She and I have certainly discussed this topic a great deal. Between us, we have eight children, and a great concern about their relationship to the church. And in our responsibilities as editors of Dialogue, we have been greatly concerned about the grain of dialogue and about coming along of new voices, new thinking, new minds, young people in the world of Mormon studies. The topic we're discussing tonight is really a political one. It's about the religious political culture in Mormonism. I make that point to point out at the same time that all politics are local, and that what I have to say this evening comes out of my own local experience and the experience of my family and the place where we live and in the place where my wife and I have individually lived before. We both grew up in Salt Lake City, but rather differently. My wife grew up in a family that wasn't at all active. Her father certainly not. Rather antagonistic towards the church, her mother going along with that. They didn't attend church, did not take her to church. But she had in her neighborhood the opportunity to go to primary with her peer group, with her friends, and did on a regular basis, and that was a happy place, a haven for her. She had a good family, but she enjoyed church. And she enjoyed going on Sunday later on, and she enjoyed going to MIA, and she became an active, committed member of the LDS Church without any model for most of her life at home. I, on the other hand, was in a very active LDS family. I had very devoted grandparents who served 8 years on a building mission in New Zealand, something that was held up as a model to us, and which we always enjoyed hearing about. Had active parents for most of my life, and thought of myself as a mainline, standard, ordinary Mormon. In some ways, I suppose I was not. My family was in some ways different. My mother was a working mother, worked most of the years that I remember. Her sisters, and she had two terrific sisters, all very influential in my life, were both working women with good educations. All three had good educations, had been very important in their family. And when we sat down to dinner, we talked about things, and the women in my family had opinions, and you knew it. And they were always models to me. One point, I remembered a family outing. I had declared that I was unwilling to wash dishes because, after all, that was women's work. And that was not a good decision. I spent 3 months every night alone washing dishes and have not been released yet. In my family, we asked questions. Often it was not church issues, often it was political issues. My mother still will keep me on the phone for an hour, my mother's 87, an hour and a half or more over what politically abhorrent is going on in Utah at the moment. She doesn't slow down, and she never puts down the newspaper. She always knows what's going on. There were discussions, and we were expected to have opinions and think and take part. In church, I like to ask questions. And that was, to me, a natural role. And I took some heat for that, but I thought it was fun. I thought probably that I was clever. But there were questions that needed to be asked, and people treated that with some deference. Had a bishop who was a member of the John Birch Society, and he was one running for local office, and he asked the kids in the ward to hand out flyers for him. Well, I had some education at home, and so I sat down with the bishop, and I asked him a whole lot of questions. And he reported that later in church. He said, "Neil Chandler made me answer questions before he delivered my flyers." Now, the bad part of that story for me is that I actually delivered those flyers. I didn't really go to seminary in high school. I went one term. I failed. And it was my fault. I really went to seminary that one term because there was a redheaded girl who was just amazing. And I sat next to her, and I spent the whole term trying to talk her out of a marriage she'd planned right after graduation to a 27-year-old medical student. And when I couldn't dissuade her, I lost interest, and I started asking questions to keep myself interested in the class. And it didn't work out, and I only flunked one other class. That was gym, my senior year, and that was for 27 straight sluts. At least I went to seminary. I hadn't planned on a mission. In some ways, that may have been rebellious of me. I didn't know everybody was going on a mission. It was such a thing to do. And I didn't want to do a thing to do. But I did go into the Army. We really had no choice. I was there for 6 months and then 7 because I got sick. And I passed every physical to get out and failed every to get in and failed everyone to get out. I finally had to absolve the Army of responsibility and they let me go home. But I had not gotten along well with authority in the Army and with the Army in general. And what I discovered there had really disillusioned me about the world outside Utah. I came to the conclusion that if this was what the world was like, there was really something genuine and something valuable about my culture. And I ought to give it a very serious try and shot. And the try I gave was a mission. And I went on with a mission with some reserve and some questions and some skepticism. And in the mission home, I was voted the elder most likely to be sent home early. But I was not sent home early. And I have to tell you that my mission was a tough experience, but one of the forming, positive, wonderful experiences of my life. I enjoyed it enormously. And I found a real sense of purpose. And I found myself able to develop a sense of commitment that kept me there. But I didn't keep the policy on wearing mission hats or mission tracting pockets. And I thought a lot of the programs that came down to the system to encourage our proselyting and change its methods were sleazy and commercial, and I said so. And I loved the mission president who agreed with me. But, you know, he gave me responsibilities and things to do in the mission, and allowed me to take a course that I thought was the right course and a fair course and an honest course. And I felt I had a place in the church. When I came home and went to school came home very much a convert to Mormonism. I was lucky enough to go to a very good graduate school. And while I was there, we developed an institute. And this was in the turbulent 60s. And we discussed a lot of things there. We discussed race issues and the priesthood. And we discussed the role and the rights of women. And we discussed war and our obligations towards military service and our obligations to oppose violence. And we discussed what was wrong with church architecture. We discussed a lot of things. And a fellow had been sent down to lead the institute, and after a while realized that that's what we were going to do, kind of went along with it and contributed to our discussions. He worried a little. Those were wonderful discussions. And we felt right at home in what we were doing. We did research. We had a wonderful library at our disposal, and we spent time in the archives reading Mormon documents, reading about our own history and the context in history, and went back to that institute with hard work done, things to say, things to contribute, and felt that it was worthwhile and valuable. And one night, we had been given an assignment to read an article out of Dialogue, which was relatively new. And we'd read an article, it was by a brother who had struggled with some issues in Mormonism, and he'd left the church. And he was describing his trip out and what had led to it, and described the fact that that, to him, at the end, had been liberating. And we looked around the table at each other and said, I know it was Warren Hansen who said, that's not an option for me. And we agreed around the table that whatever things we were discussing, and however difficult the issues were, and the race issue in particular was a terrible, difficult issue for us then, and the women's issue was becoming so, whatever difficulty we encountered, the option of leaving was not an option that felt open or real to us. This was our church, and we were in for the long haul, and we cared, and because we were cared, we were there. That was an exhilarating time. We started at 8 o'clock on a Friday night. The library closed at 12 or 12:30. They kicked us out. Even in the cold, sometimes in February and March, you could find us outside talking until 2 or 3 in the morning. A great time. I wanted to tell you that because I want to contrast it with a young person I know. Well, she's young to me. My wife says I'm almost done. She's cutting me off, and I'll hurry up. A friend in our ward who's left the church. She's a research scientist, enormously capable. Her parents are both faculty at BYU. She was active in church most of her life for various kinds of reasons, some having to do with her scientific background, some to do with personal experiences, left, is no longer active. This is painful to her because of her parents whom she loves. But she said to me one day when we were discussing this, you're a different generation than mine. You felt ownership in the church. You felt you were part of it. There was a place for you and you had a role to play and you stayed and fought. My generation, people with my experience, don't think it's worth it. Don't think there's hope. It's easier and better to leave. My friends have gone. I was talking to Albert Peck one day about a young scholar who was doing Mormon studies and seemed very promising, and I thought would be a leader in Mormon studies in the near future. And he said, don't be too quick about this. He said, watch him. He's headed off to graduate school. I give him 3 years. I don't think he'll be a member, or at least an active member anymore. And I paid attention to that and watched, and he was right. 3 years, maybe not quite that long, I'd become inactive, not involved in Mormon studies or in Mormonism anymore. I worry that that's a pattern that's asserted itself among young Mormon scholars. I can't document it. I haven't done the surveys. But I sometimes, and I think as an editor, sometimes have the feeling that we're losing some of the best and the brightest. I want to talk just quickly about our children. our own children. One of the things that we've learned from our reading is that their decision-making is influenced by a number of things, certainly parents. But peer group is enormously important. Enormously important. And peer groups can be the determining factor. I want to agree with Eller Holland in some sense, or at least one narrow sense, and that is that some of the decisions and some of the things that we do will have consequences. We've made some decisions in our life that I think for our children have consequences. One is the decision of where we live. When we moved into the suburb in which we live, two suburbs, but we've not moved very far in the time we've been there, we picked it carefully. It was a inner city, an inner ring suburb, close to the university. It had a very diverse population and good schools, and integrated population, and that was important to us. Certain members in the ward took us aside early on as we moved there and advised us against buying a house where we were buying. No one ever said the word, but the implication was that to buy in an area where black people lived, shared the community, would not be a financially helpful decision. And they were probably right over long term. Certainly the houses where we live, all their wonderful houses, have not appreciated the way the houses have appreciated in the suburbs to which we were invited to move. The other thing that happened is that we isolated ourselves to some degree from Mormon families. Mormon families live out in the neighborhoods that are safely white, where there are no issues of race, where there's no encroaching city border. So that our kids did not have the peer group that other kids have. In one stretch of years, two of our sons were the only two Aaronic priesthood holders, bunched together in one course. We asked the state over a period of time if they couldn't get us together with other wards, expand that, do something to give them a peer group. And we had explained to us that we should make do with what the Lord had provided. So the Lord provided one teacher, well, a few teachers over time, to meet with two boys who hated that priesthood class. Their peer group, you know, we could have moved out to the other suburbs, but their peer group was each other. Of course, they were old enough to fight. I've got 2 minutes left. On the other hand, one day we were out in one of those far suburbs at a pancake breakfast, and we had all our children with us, and our oldest daughter was visibly uncomfortable. Something was wrong. Not used to being there. And finally she said to us, "I'm not comfortable here, and I just figured out why." We said, "What's wrong, dear?" She said, "We've been here for an hour and there are no black people." And she had not lived in a world where that made sense to her. She was uncomfortable. And that to me is a moment I remember because to me it's valuable. And it explains a lot to me today about who she is. So we've made some decisions that were trouble. Finally, and I can't go on about this, I want to talk about my children. And I don't have 50% in, and those who are in are probably still testing the waters. What we want them to be, or would like them to be, is Mormons, border Mormons, Sunstone Mormons, the kind of Mormons that I think we sort of see ourselves as, but Mormons who feel they have a place in the church and a role and a commitment, not because there are no problems. There are no doubts to be raised, but because raising them is an act of commitment and love, not an act of rebellion. And they're not sure they can find that place or role in the church. But I admire my children. I love them. I hope they can make their peace with the church as we've tried to make our peace and do our part. But I think they're generous, good people. I admire their idealism and their activism, whether they're involved in the church or not. Their commitment to one another, the way they take care of each other and of other people.
Many years ago, when I got married, I was a very Orthodox Mormon and thought that I always would be. I never dreamed that I would have any reason to question anything about the church, really. I think it was Neil who wrote an article for Dialogue a while back called Book of Mormon Stories That My Teachers Kept From Me. Well, I found out there were some church history stories that my teachers kept from me also. And there were a few things about women in the church that hadn't ever really sunk in when I was young and that I started raising questions about as I got older. Elder Holland, Vicki read all of the quotes from the article that I was going to read, but I'll just reread this one. He had said that there's lots of room for studying and comparing and considering, but then he said that we can be reasonably active, meeting-going Latter-day Saints, but basically we have to teach our children that our belief in the divine guidance of the church from the first vision to this very hour. And if we don't, we shouldn't be surprised if our children turn out to be not visibly active, meeting-going Latter-day Saints. Having learned the stories that my teachers kept from me, I came to realize that anybody who really looks at the contradictions in church history can't possibly reconcile the idea that the church was always divinely guided, because there are just too many contradictions. It just took too many mental gymnastics for me to continue to believe that, and so I had to find a way to be in the church and have integrity. Brother Holland uses the term gospel integrity. Well, gospel integrity can't mean that you have to believe in the divine guidance of the church every minute, unless the term gospel integrity includes lying for the Lord. I'm sure I don't have to recount the kinds of troubling issues that I stumbled across in studying church history and even church doctrine and things to this group, but I was bothered by the church's anti-ERA crusade. Somebody never told me that Joseph Smith had, how many wives, Todd? 33 wives. Or that some of them were teenagers, or that he lied about his practice of polygamy. And so I did a lot of thinking about where to pitch my tent, although that particular metaphor hadn't really occurred to me. But I wanted my children to grow up having faith in God, believing in a loving God. Like Janice, I'm moved by the founding story of Mormonism, that a 14-year-old boy can go to God and ask a question and God will answer, and that God can speak to us. And so I wanted my children to experience the kind of loving belief that I had in God. But I also... Well, and I wanted them to appreciate their Mormon heritage also, which I think is a very interesting and fascinating and wonderful heritage. But I also wanted them to be able to think for themselves and to take responsibility for their beliefs and their actions. I wanted them to enjoy the best things about the church, the many wholesome activities that young people do in the church, and not just activities, but having other adults besides just their parents who care about them and who want to give them guidance and who are willing to love them and take them under their wing. And kids need a lot of help growing up, and I felt like that was something that was very good for my kids, to have the relationships of other young people and other adults with common values. And I also wanted to teach them feminist and humanistic values as well, and those were not necessarily things that they got at church. But they're part of me and the way I believe in life and the way I believe in treating other people. And one thing I know about kids is that you have to be honest with them, because if you're not, they know it. And my concern about Elder Holland's talk was that he really is asking us not to be honest with our kids if we have doubts, if we have questions. And I just don't think that you can do that and raise your kids authentically. So in trying to figure out how to reconcile my beliefs and my changing understanding of the church and deciding whether I wanted to be in the church or not, I realized that I needed to find a place in the church and make a place for myself. As the things like the September 6th and all the pressure against symposia were coming down, I asked myself, well, is it worth it to stay in? And I decided, yes, it is. And it's my church, and I'm not going to just let them push me out of it. And it's my church as much as it's their church. And so I just sort of elbowed my way into a place that was big enough for me. And one of the things I did was, I was always very active in the church, and I started speaking up in meetings. And instead of just, you know, simmering silently, suffering silently, I would like read the lesson material ahead of time and think about it a little bit. And then when I'd go to church, I'd have the opportunity to maybe suggest some insights that people hadn't heard of before. And it helped that I lived in the Bay Area, where diversity is valued even by conservatives. And I eventually, people in my ward began to really look forward to my comments. And sometimes, if I didn't make comments, they'd come up to me after the meeting and say, "Why did you let them get away with that?" And I had a really wonderful relationship with the other ward members. And so I realized that if I didn't let other people define my relationship to the church, but I took it upon myself to define my own relationship and then just be myself, it really worked out wonderfully. And people were very accepting. I don't know if that would have been true in Utah, but it certainly was true where I lived. And I've got a ward member sitting there back there smiling. At home, I always wanted to keep the lines of communications open with my kids. I always thought that was very important. And so when the kids came home from church with some kind of a troubling idea, I'd sit down and talk to them about it and try to help them find some better interpretations of what they'd been learning. And let me give you a couple of examples. In our ward, we had a former stake president who was very influential, and he believed in a very young earth and in creationism. And he thought the earth was about 13,000 years old and that Adam and Eve had been created in an unmortal state and had literally eaten something that caused their bodies to become mortal, and that was the fall. And that was a very important belief to him, because the way he understood the atonement was that if you didn't have a fall, you don't need a savior. And so creationism was so important to him, because if you didn't have creationism, the whole underlying notion of the atonement and redemption was undercut. And so partly because he was a former state president, was very influential, a lot of people took his views seriously. And so when my kids, or actually this was, I remember my son coming home from seminary and talking about this. I think his wife was teaching seminary at the time. And so when he came home and started talking about what he'd learned in seminary, I got out the book Life on Earth, which was the companion book to the PBS series about Life on Earth by David Attenborough. It had beautiful pictures in it. And so I got it out and showed him how the fossil record shows that the simplest life forms were about, like, I think it was 3.5 billion years old, and how you could date the fossil record over billions of years and see the progression of life. And then we also did things like take our kids to the Grand Canyon and take them out to Dinosaur National Monument and things like that. And then I had the William Stokes letter, David O. McKay letter to William Stokes that said that Joseph Fielding Smith's ideas about man, his origin and destiny, were his own views and not the views of the church. And then there's an Encyclopedia of Mormonism article. It really takes a very neutral position on evolution. And so I would point out that the things that he had been taught in seminary were not the official position of the church. They were just somebody's opinion. And for Laura, who is my more avid reader, I gave her The Dragons of Eden by Carl Sagan, which talks about Eden as a metaphor for the evolution of human intelligence. Laura was always kind of more into being able to see symbolism that way and take inspiration from it. Vicki said something about her kids were protected from her views. Well, what I did was I protected my kids from a lot of church views and sort of taught them that just because you hear something at church doesn't mean that it's really the official teaching of the church. We also would talk about church history sometimes, and we took a long trip across the country and visited church history sites, and including Carthage Jail. And I had talked to the kids about what happened, why Joseph was in Carthage Jail, and how he had the Nauvoo Expositor Press destroyed. And when Laura was in seminary, she came home one day and told me that it was a church history year, and they had been talking about Carthage, and I think the teacher asked them if they knew why Joseph Smith had been imprisoned, and she said because he had the Nauvoo Expositor Press destroyed. And the teacher said, no, he didn't. And Laura was, I think she stood her ground and continued to insist that was in fact why he was arrested. But she came home and talked to me about it. So I went and got out Carthage Conspiracy by Dallin Oaks and Marvin Hill and let her read the chapter on it. I don't know if Elder Oaks was camped on the margins of the Mormon camp when he wrote the book, I wanted my kids to be able to deal with the questions of Mormon history with the realization that our forebears were human beings and they made mistakes. And, you know, if God can work with people who made mistakes then he can work with me now. So I did a lot of things like that to try to help my kids develop love and appreciation for the church, but at the same time be able to think for themselves and make their own decisions and not feel that they always had to follow the prophet, as has been such a big mantra in the last 10 years or so. They should always respect church leaders and consider their words. But in the end, they're responsible for what they do and what they think. And that was always very important to me, that they do that. Ironically, I think that Elder Holland's statement that the children of people like me who are not taught that the church was guided minute by minute by the Lord, it might become less active. I think that might be a prophetic statement. Unfortunately, it doesn't take a gift of prophecy to be able to make that statement, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. When Elder Holland tells us that we aren't to ask questions, he's telling us to sit down and shut up, and he's telling our children the same thing. And I think that at this point, the fact is, the children of all kinds of parents leave the church, from the most orthodox to the most heterodox. And it's very naive now to think that children are not going to be confronted with a lot of questions about the church. Our kids have access to the internet, and those who are really interested in religion are going to find a lot of things that they didn't tell us about when I was in seminary, and that they still don't tell kids about in seminary. And there's a good chance that many of them will feel very betrayed if they get taught one thing and then they find out that things are different. Just as many of us have felt that sense of betrayal. In the closing scenes of The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy and her companions have been sent out to for these various ordeals by the wizard. And they're back and they're talking to the wizard, and Toto runs up and he pulls the curtain away. And he says, "Pay no attention to the man behind the screen." And they realize that this guy is not really a wizard, and Dorothy gets very angry and she says, "You're a very bad man." And he says, no, child, I'm not a very bad man. I'm just a very bad wizard." We don't need church leaders who are wizards, and children don't need parents who are wizards. What we need is people who will deal with questions openly and honestly, and who will be willing to listen. If young adults today are leaving the church in significant numbers, and there seems to be at least some anecdotal evidence that they are, maybe it's because church leaders need to listen to them and listen to what their concerns are, and not just think that they can blame parents who might have their tents pitched on the margins of the camp, because those are not the only parents, obviously, whose children are going to leave. About 3 years ago, my husband wrote a letter to our kids, and in the letter he told them about what his beliefs are and told them essentially that they're free to believe what works for them. We want our children to find their own spiritual path. And if that path is in the church, that's wonderful. Walking away from that path is always painful in a lot of ways when you have extended family who are in the church. But if that path doesn't work for them, then what we really want most for our kids is for them to be happy, to be healthy, to be loving individuals, and to have a good sense of themselves and their place in the universe, and to feel a loving relationship with God. And if the price of staying in the church costs them their integrity, if it can only be conformity at the expense of being honest with themselves, then that's too high a price. So our wish for our children is that they will continue to be the wonderful, happy, and productive people that they are.
Okay, if you're hot and tired and hungry, feel free to stand up. It won't bother me because I'm the same. But we should be done in time, you know. If everybody gets their fans going, it'll make the air go. My parents did a real good job inoculating us to some of the scary parts of church history, as you can tell. And as a result, though, I think that it's really kind of, nothing surprises me anymore when I come to Sunstone Symposiums, or I'm reading on the internet and I hear some crazy thing and somebody's going off about how awful some church thing was and how concerned and stressed out they are and how it's going to ruin their testimony. And I think, well, you know, why should that surprise you? These people are human beings just like us. I mean, so they, my parents did a good job teaching us that there were lots of ways to look at situations. This spring, I do a lot of hiking, and early this spring, I went out on a backpacking trip, and I ended up taking a path that was a lot steeper and longer than I thought it was going to be when I started out. And as a result, I was pretty wiped out, and it took about twice as long as I had planned to take this, to take the path. And I stopped several times on my way, and I thought, you know what? What am I doing here? I'm just going to turn around and go back. But I'm a little bit stubborn, and I kept going, and eventually I made it to the camp. And when I got to camp, I thought, the last thing that I want to hear is somebody who's already there telling me what an easy trip they had because they went the other way. And luckily I didn't hear that, but the next day when I left, I went back a different way, and I had a chance to berate myself because I could have gone a lot easier way, and I was really mad. But then I thought about it, though, and if I would have gone the easy way, I wouldn't have had that sense of accomplishment from having gone the hard way. And I would have missed out on a lot of really cool views and seeing a lot of things and really feeling like I had done something that was really, really hard. So I kind of, you know, consoled myself with that thought that I did a really hard thing. But it really drove home a lesson to me that there are lots of ways to get to destinations. And there isn't one correct way that's going to work for everybody else. Elder Holland's talk kind of suggests to me that journeys that don't include questions, doubts, skepticism, or less than faith-promoting stories are really actually less than valid journeys. He suggests that members with questions and doubts shouldn't share or explore those questions because they might lead others, especially those with less understanding, astray. I would like to propose that not only are journeys that include questions and doubts just as valid as the non-doubting journeys, but that unless we tell others about our own doubts and questions, we leave them suffering alone in the wilderness, exposing them to more danger as they battle the elements on their own. Very recently, I was on another strenuous hike through the woods, but this time I wasn't by myself, and I had somebody there with me. And the trail was just as steep, and it was just as long, and this time it got dark before we got to the end of the trail. But, you know, just knowing that there was somebody there with me on the trail made a huge difference in my perspective. And I just, it was not frustrating to me. I didn't feel exhausted. And so sometimes just knowing that there's somebody out there who's going through similar things is just enough to keep you involved and keep you going on. And I think that as people, those of us who are familiar with the gospel, we need to work with the people around us to help them deal with the doubts and questions that they have. They need to know they're not alone. And one of the most important skills that we can teach children is how to find answers to tough questions without throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Questions aren't always going to be answerable in black and white. With black and white answers. And really, life's tough questions aren't answerable in black and white. There's too many shades of gray. There's too many points of view. There's too many options to really be able to say there's just this one right way and this one wrong way. And that's one thing that my parents, as my mom had said, have really encouraged us to do. They encourage us to look for answers. They encourage us to ask questions and to learn things. I remember one of the first sacrament talks that I ever gave was centered around the Doctrine and Covenants scripture that says, if a person gains more knowledge and intelligence in this life through his diligence and obedience than another, he will have so much the advantage in the world to come. To me, that meant that God thinks that knowledge is important. And it also means that God expects you to ask questions. And he expects you to keep asking those questions until you find answers or until you understand something thoroughly. Because like the Chinese proverb says, one who asks a question is a fool for 5 minutes. One who does not ask a question is a fool for a lifetime. My parents put up with lots of questions from me, many of them beginning with the words how or why. How did God create the world in only 7 days? How did kangaroos get saved from extinction with the flood? Why can't girls pass the sacrament? Why was polygamy so important that leaders would lie about it? Sometimes my parents would answer my questions directly. But more often they responded with something like, well, that's a really good question. What do you think about that? Then we'd have some really good discussions. And usually what happened with those discussions is that as we talked back and forth and involved other people and looked at stuff in books, we found out that there's really lots of ways to look at questions, and that people have different answers, and that just because your answers are different doesn't mean that they're invalid. And we also found out that some questions you just don't have answers. The model that my parents gave me was a really good background for me growing up, and it has given me the strength to kind of find what's important to me and accept it in my life, and know that if I can't come up with an answer, that it's still okay. I just still need to keep looking and keep studying and learning. As far as I could tell growing up in my home, there weren't any dangerous questions that were, you know, any question was valid, and it wasn't threatening to have to, you know, you didn't have to self-censor what you said or what you asked, because the discussion was open and it was allowed, and that was really important, because for me, I need to ask questions to be able to understand my world, and I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that God accepts any and all questions that we have, if for no other reason than just that God communicates with us in languages that we can understand. So if I only understand the world through questions and answers, then God is going to communicate to me through questions and answers. And if God accepts questions, then God's organization should be accepting questions also. Right now in the Seesaw of Life, the church kind of seems to be putting a little bit of emphasis on we have all the answers, and every question has a firm answer, so don't rock the boat by suggesting more questions. And the rigidity that this non-questioning worldview tries to impose on my life isn't particularly comfortable for me right now. I would rather have one person tell me completely honestly that they have questions, but that they still find value in the gospel, than I would have a million people telling me that it's absolutely true, no doubts whatsoever. Because for me, that does not seem like it doesn't seem valid for somebody to be able to say that they accept everything that they know about the church without questions, because that's just like if I went on the hard hiking trail and somebody went on the easy hiking trail, I wouldn't be able to understand that they had an easy path because my path was hard. And if somebody says that they don't have questions, I have a hard time believing that they're really telling me the truth. And revelation, you know, comes from questions. Joseph Smith, God didn't go down and just whack Spencer Kimball on the head and say, guess what, it's time to give back the priesthood. He had to ask first. He didn't say to Joseph Smith, it's time to start a new church. Joseph had to ask first. When we stifle the questions and we don't allow them space, how are we going to find out what God wants us to do in our lives? How are we going to know where He wants the church to go? If I were giving Elder Holland's talk, I would modify it a little bit and pick out some of my favorite parts. Questions are good. We need to seek wisdom. In our search for wisdom and knowledge, we need to be aware that there are people depending on us in their search for answers as well. We have a responsibility to be honest with them and to explain that we're not perfect and we don't have all the answers, that the ones who really deserve your faith are God and Jesus Christ. We need to explain to our children that we are not the light, we're only a window or a reflection of the light. Kids are smart. They can figure out when you're telling the truth or not. When they discover that you've made something up, they remember it. And there's a good chance that every other potentially doubtful thing that you've ever said to them will be coming into question very shortly. And then your answers to those questions, even though they might have been perfectly true and valid answers and appropriate answers, they'll remember the one time that you said something that wasn't true, and they will likely apply that to all the other answers that you had. But in all of our teaching and allowing questions and telling the truth and helping people understand the church and the gospel, we need to be very careful also not to flood seedling testimonies with too much water or sunshine or fertilizer. Just like you wouldn't start teaching a three-year-old about astrophysics when she asks what a star is, you don't need to flood investigators, no matter what ages, with all the gory details of church doctrine the first time they ask if Mormons are Christians. But you do need to teach the truth. You might tell the child that stars are flaming balls of fire far, far away and not holes in a papier-mâché sky. And you might tell an investigator that Mormons are Christians who believe in continuing revelation and that sometimes the revelations don't always make exact sense. When the child asks how far away the stars are, you might take into account the age and understanding of the child and answer appropriately. Maybe you just say that the stars are farther away than Grandma's house. Or maybe you start to explain light years to them. You do the same thing with an investigator or a new convert or a questioning believer. Adjust your answers to their questions according to their levels of understanding. But whatever you do, it's a complete disservice to lie to the questioner. Our responsibility is to provide fair, accurate, and honest information without being inflammatory, accusatory, or derisive. Just as it is a sin to force people to obey blindly, it is also a sin to tear down their support structures just because we don't agree with them or because we think we have a better understanding of the truth. We need to create a space where conversation and questions are allowed and encouraged, and when questions are asked, we need to be sensitive to the needs of the folks we're talking with. For instance, I wouldn't just walk into a Sunday school class and regale with everyone with all the questions I've ever had and all the information I've ever learned at every Sunstone Symposium I've ever been to. But I could easily raise my hand in class and ask the teacher why something is one way or another, or I might request backup for an opinion that an institute director is telling us firmly is fact, but turns out is only his opinion. And just by speaking up quietly, like my mom talked about, people, you're providing a light to the people around you who might even be feeling a little bit guilty because they have questions. And as we do that, as the people who are younger than us can see that there's a place for them to have questions, and it opens up the door, and it's a relief to know that they're not alone and that there's a place for people who have questions. And it's our responsibility to provide that space because it's not being provided anywhere else. And as long as we remain silent and don't open up those doors, they're not going to even try to keep walking through the doors. They're just going to continue to flood out, and we won't have young people coming to Sunstone, and we won't have young people studying Mormon history, and they'll just, because they won't have the ownership of the church, and it won't be as important to them, because it's a very painful thing to have all of your beliefs toppled and to hear that somebody that you revered as a prophet was actually not perfect. I think that God is bigger than a lot of things in the world, even bigger than the box that's defined by Orthodox Mormonism. And as such, there's a place for everyone in the kingdom of God. The only problem is that sometimes when you're having a particularly question-filled day or week or life, it might feel that the only one accepting you is God. The organization might give you the boot or at least a very cold shoulder, but you still have the relationship with God in the first place, and you know in your heart that God's circle is bigger than all the circles made by human beings. We can exclude each other as much as we want, but God just draws a bigger circle around all of us. And when we realize that we're in the same circle anyway, that's when we finally drop the barriers and have the unity that God intends. I see the church now as kind of being in an awkward teenage sort of phase. It survived its infancy and childhood when it thought it was the most important kid on the block and it could do anything. It's almost out of the junior high, all the other kids are picking on me all the time phase. And now it's kind of dealing with the growing pains of adolescence. It's grappling with statements like, I have to fit into the right crowd so nobody thinks I'm too weird. Every 6 months, I outgrow all of my clothes and I need something new. I want to be my own person but can only define myself as what my parents are not. There's so much going on inside of me that I haven't had time to process it all and think about it, so I'm ruled by my emotions, and I'm trying to control those emotions by manipulating my environment, even if that means I have to exclude everyone else from my thought process. Eventually, though, the church will outgrow its teenage angst. We all have. And the church will be able to get off of its emotional teenage roller coaster and look at life from the adult side. I think we will know when that happens because the messages emanating from headquarters will sound different than they do now. In the Doctrine and Covenants, there's a verse that says that a person might as well stick their arm in the Missouri River to try to keep it from flowing as to try to stop the work of God from progressing. We can all stick our arms in the river. The water's still going to keep going. When we stop hearing defensive public relations stances being taken, that will be a sign of our church's maturity. When church history doesn't need to be faith-promoting to be valuable, that will be a sign of acceptance of ourselves. When our focus changes from easily measured statistics and numbers to the more nebulous and difficult task of addressing the real needs of investigators, members, and neighbors, we'll know that we're truly being Christians. And when we don't have to worry about whether or not the rest of the world thinks we're Christians, then we'll know that we are saints and worthy to be called such.